I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Luis Betancourt. He is a professor at the Santa Fe Institute, and tonight he'll be giving a lecture titled The Fabric of Our Lives, Cities, Slums, Neighborhoods, and People. That's at 7:30 at the James A. Little Theater on the campus of the Santa Fe School for the Deaf. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mayor Charlotte. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's talk about cities, which are a phenomenon that arose at a certain point in the history of humanity. How old are the oldest cities on Earth, and what do we know about them?
Mm-hmm. So people fight a little bit about that, about what makes a city be a city. But something like 8,000, 9,000 years ago, we can say that we had the first cities, mostly in the Middle East.
And how did they come to be, and why? Do we know?
So I think that that is already the beginning of the big question. The big question really is, what is it that cities do in human societies that keeps them around, of course, and makes them grow? But what is their role in human societies that really change us? And much of the lecture will be about that, about, in some sense, what is the fabric, what is sort of the entanglements that cities as places, but also as social networks, create between people that allow us to start learning and doing different things and depending on each other in ways that change our societies, but also allow us to develop new technologies, new forms of government, and things that ultimately we associate with civilization, but also associate with this continuous change that we're now experiencing so fast in human societies.
It seems like an amazing jump from hunter-gatherer society to cities.
Right. So there's a sense in which it is not, and there's a sense in which it is, of course. The sense in which it is not is that cities do the same thing that hunter-gatherer societies did before, in the sense that the emphasis on society, in the sense that people always have been social. Cities sort of start creating the conditions for that sociality to become the primary thing we do. So they're really, I like to call them social reactors. They're really places where a lot of people can come together and spend most of that time interacting with other people. And what that means is that when a lot of people come together, we can start differentiating. So you can become a radio DJ or a scientist or a builder or whatever. And then we depend on each other to build all these things around us. So the first cities were basically small settlements where still a life of small-scale agriculture, subsistence, hunter-gathering, sort of our relationship with the natural environment was coinciding with sort of other things that are more social, that we associate with modern life. And so that change has been progressive. But now, of course, with cities with tens of millions of people, you don't see so much the connection with the immediate physical environment. You see sort of just the social part of it.
So there are so many cities on the planet, and they're really different from one another.
Mm-hmm.
What determines those differences? What determines their size? What determines their attractiveness as a place where mm-hmm. everybody wants mm-hmm. to go, or everybody wants to leave all of a sudden, mm-hmm. things mm-hmm. like that?
So those are really important questions and difficult questions. And ultimately, we don't know those answers in detail. But part of our work is trying to address those. So, and I think, to be fair, there's a whole field that's developing around those questions, partly because we can study cities much better than we used to. There's more data, there's more opportunities to know, more opportunities to visit, etc. So so the answers are essentially that cities are places where social life opens up, in the sense that I was starting to describe, in which you can have, in some sense, access to what we identify with modern life, with a career, opportunity to learn, opportunity to make more money possibly, education for kids, health. All these things are properties that even in developing countries or through history, you see developing first in large cities in that system and before they become common everywhere. So there's a sense in which it's not a simple answer. It's not just about money or just about politics. It's really a transformation of life across many dimensions, from a life again of isolation and subsistence to a life of interconnection that allows us to, in some sense, have access to all these things that we identify with change and well-being.
It seems like often They're either on a cities are either on a river or a railroad or something like that. So there is an economic basis to the formation of a city in a particular place. Is that true?
Early on, yes, that's typically true. So cities are places of transit and connection. So there are connections internal to the city, but a city also, particularly as it becomes large, depends on, you know, things coming in and some other things going out. And in modern cities, we do that also through telecommunications and other ways. But of course, there are physical food and energy that need to come in. And in some sense, movements of people that move around ideas and other things. So cities benefit from being in the technical word central places, among other cities, places where transportation is easy. But having said that, throughout history, cities have become increasingly less material. And also transportation costs relative to the costs of other things have come down. So those things are less important possibly than they used to be. And you have cities like, I don't know, Phoenix, Arizona, which of course is on highways, and this is common among many American cities, but that's not close to a big port or airport or anything. And those things then develop around the city with modern technology. So those things sometimes are important, but they're less important now that transportation technologies are, in some sense, cheaper and more developed.
And at the same time, I would imagine that those cities are vulnerable to whatever breakdown could happen in those technologies.
Of course, always. So cities, because they create this this disequilibrium, right? They're creating sort of an open-ended dynamics by which, as I was saying before, our lives are changing. But they're also predicated on creating good things and not bad things. So there's sort of stresses inside the city that, you know, people are not necessarily good to each other. And so cities are very prone to outbreaks of violence and bad governance. And we see that throughout the world, just looking at the news. But also they're vulnerable, of course, for their relationship with the environment and their ability to, of course, get food and energy and their ability to have something to exchange for that.
So what technologies have influenced the development of cities over the, well, I mean, millennia, but let's say over the last few centuries?
There's a certain sense, again, in which cities are about essentially the same thing, but the form of that thing has changed over time. So cities, again, are predicated on people being able to live in large societies. So that means that you need to have ways of dealing with strangers. That means that you develop political institutions and conflict resolution and all those social things. And you also need people to move around and things to move around. So you need to develop transportation technologies and networks that allow things to move. Now, what those things are and how we deal with each other changes through history. Of course, we have different political institutions than in the past, and that can be, has its own path dependence, and different places develops in different ways. And of course, transportation has changed immensely in the way, for example, we keep information and move information around has really changed drastically, of course. So, but there's a sense in which the conditions for creating these connections, the way to be social, the way to move around, the way to move things to us, those are the fundamental technologies that allow these networks, which is really the fundamental nature of cities, to exist. And then there's a sense in which we're always trying through history to improve on those technologies, make them more pervasive, more powerful across many more modes, cheaper in terms of other things we create and so forth. So you can look at, in some sense, at the history of technology through that lens, and I think it clarifies lots of interesting things.
I can't help but think of things that are just simple, like chlorination, having a huge influence on the development of cities.
One of the biggest problems historically with cities as they get larger is sanitation, of course, and water supply. Cities that grow very fast tends to a large extent, the crowding creates conditions that can obviously be quite bad for contagious diseases, and diarrheal diseases and that sort of thing are really the thing that is historically killed more people than anything else. So chlorination, sanitation, though they're not glamorous things, are very important in creating the conditions to have large cities.
We're talking to Luis Betancourt from the Santa Fe Institute. And of course, the Santa Fe Institute is a place that has brought forth the study of complex systems. And the city is a kind of complex system, as is an animal, as is an ecosystem. Do you think of the city as a kind of organism? I mean, in the title of your lecture that's happening tonight, you use the metaphor of a fabric.
So there's a sense in which what we study, as we were saying, at the Institute have to do with this sort of system, complex, and often we add the word adaptive system, systems that evolve in some generalized sense, not just in the biological sense. But so that means that there are some commonalities among all these complex systems, but also fundamentally some differences. And so that's what we've been discovering in the process of trying to understand what cities are and creating new concepts, new theory about them. We've been trying to understand what is similar and what is different to other complex systems. So the word fabric relates to some of the things we were saying before, that cities are really places for social connection, for social interchange, for social contact. So that's a network of a sort, a social network. But then they exist in space. So space becomes very important in the structuring of space in terms of infrastructure, things that allow us to move around and to move around things to us are essential. So all these networks, they're all interconnected. They form this interesting fabric. And this fabric is also very dynamical. It's something that changes as cities grow, as technologies change, and so forth. So that's sort of what I'll be talking about a lot, is what is the nature of that fabric. Now, that fabric shares a few things with things like organisms, but also has some fundamental differences. So organisms and many other complex systems need also to move, say, nutrients around in networks. So that's the sense in which there are networks that have to go everywhere in the city and everywhere in the organism. But there's a sense in which they're also very different, and in fact, their numbers, their geometry is different, because cities are built in a way that's open-ended, that keeps changing, keeps evolving, keeps growing. And organisms, there's a sense in which they're built once, and then it is just a predicament of evolution that they need to die in order for that to be evolution. So we should be happy in some sense that cities are a little different, because we don't want to have, we don't have to kill them in order to have change. Cities are really places that are built in a certain way for change, and so the networks that make cities because of that are different.
I mean, one thing that I or and probably many other people think of as a similarity is in the human body we have cells and organs that do very specific jobs, and in cities you have a much greater division of labor than you do in maybe a village or a hunter-gatherer society, something like that.
So that's exactly right. So again, another parallel that you see across complex systems is this specialization, division of labor, and also we should stress interdependence of those components of labor in order to create the whole again. And so there's a sense, again, paralleling what I just said, that in organisms this happens to a point and then sort of stops once you build an organism. And if your cells continue to differentiate more, you either kill them or they kill you. It's not good. So there's sort of a program from the beginning that tells you how much to differentiate and how to build this thing that's your body. But with cities, it's sort of different, and that's what's so interesting about them. You have a similar process, but it's a process that really is open-ended, where that diversity that you're creating through you being a radio DJ, me being a scientist, people doing all kinds of different things, is sort of keeps changing as cities get larger, as technologies change, as there are more things to learn and the more things get invented. And so that openness is really special because it really creates systems that they themselves evolve. You don't need to kill them in order to have novelty. So understanding the basis for that really is something I think fairly new in complex systems. And studying the city allows you to have sort of these perspectives, but also understand what are the important conditions in that fabric that allows it to change without breaking.
Well, and this is the thing that is, I think, so interesting to you here at the Santa Fe Institute and to so many of us, which is that cities last so much longer than countries, it seems, and they last longer than companies, and they last longer than a lot of things. And so they've got a longevity and persistence. How do you understand that?
So it goes back to this issue that we know this mostly from biological theory, from evolution by natural selection. The things that last long, the things that could in principle last forever, are things that have to do with information. So your genes can live forever, but of course our bodies die. So that's one example. So there's a sense in which you could think that an ecosystem, because as it changes, as individuals die, but somehow it goes on as new individuals are born and genes get passed on, can live forever. And there's a sense in which, so complex systems can be and can have these two natures, the nature in which they're built for preserving information, like an organism, perhaps like a company, though that gets us into other territory and gets more complicated. And then there are these other complex systems that are often made of the first kind, but that they themselves can, at least in principle, change and keep changing and evolving forever. So if you take, again, the ecosystem, that may be the case. But the city seems to be another instantiation of that, that's different in terms of how it does it. It's faster. It may take more energy, and it does that in a different way. But at the same time, seems to be open-ended, seems to be a place where, not always, but often, that change can go on forever. Having said that, you know, we live in New Mexico, and you can go around the state and see all the little mining towns and so forth that have died. And one of the things that has killed cities over in history tends to have to do with conflict and war. So cities do die sometimes.
Well, and when you talk about mining towns, you use up the economic base of the mining right. town, namely the mineral.
Right. So in that sense, there's a sense in which cities can actually not be so much city-like in the sense that I was describing, and be more like an organism or a corporation. Something has a very narrow base in terms of its resources and in terms of its function.
And that's really, I mean, I don't know if you differentiate between the fundamental nature of a town and a city, but a mining town maybe doesn't even qualify as mm-hmm. really being a city.
Mm-hmm. Well, we could argue about that, but there will be senses in which it will look a little bit like a city, of course, but one that has less of what you were asking about before, this division of labor and this open-endedness of that process. So often cities that are very specialized in terms of what they do, which sometimes can be very good as long as that business line keeps going, tend to do well for a while, but they find it difficult to change.
Like Detroit, perhaps.
That's another example, of course, of a much larger city. That so that's a more complicated story, in that we tend to associate the problems of Detroit with the city of Detroit, the political city of Detroit. And that is correct, but part of what happened to Detroit, of course, was that it was a fairly specialized, you know, Motown, car for motor industry, but also it sort of separated. It became a city that a lot of the resources that exist in the region went to outside the city of Detroit, but still exists in the suburbs. But that means that the city of Detroit cannot tap some of those resources and becomes a more complicated political problem and so forth. But as a metropolitan area, as a larger city, sort of the more organic city, a lot of Detroit is there. It just became sort of physically disconnected, and unfortunately also socially disconnected in some ways.
Now, you were trained as a theoretical physicist. How did you get into this city work? Do you love cities? Do you have a passion for cities?
Yes, I think I always loved cities. And so I never thought I could actually turn cities early on into a subject of science. So I'm happy that that has been possible. But, you know, it's also, I think, a little personal. I was, you know, as I was doing physics, I sort of think I had a bit of a handicap that I do like people. And I the thing that really fascinates me as a subject has always been, how is it that we create all this stuff around us? You know, when you go to a large city, but even as you go around Santa Fe, there's all this art, all this knowledge, all these beautiful buildings. Where does all that come from? And how does it persist? How does it change? And I think in some sense, these are really the big questions, the questions for which we have not had good science in the past, and that increasingly are opening up as we have better ideas about these issues, but also better data.
We're talking to Luis Betancourt, professor at the Santa Fe Institute. It seems that the knowledge of a city, when you want to know New York, maybe you look at the art or read the poetry or the theater or the films about New York, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. you get a feel for that. You as scientists are doing something, I mean, maybe not entirely unrelated or uninspired by that, but nevertheless, you are gathering data. How do you do that study? What kind of data are you gathering? Mm-hmm. How are you using it?
So I personally enjoy really doing all of it. just what you described, you know, read a lot about what has been written or said about cities from artists and poets and all kinds of people that know the city well. And but as well as, of course, collecting things that measure the size of a city's economy or of its infrastructure or whatever. And those things, it's really, I think, the challenge in doing good work in this field is really somehow to bring all that together and to really have a sense of what the city is as, in this case, a creative space. But a creative space not just for artists and poets and scientists. Really, you know, I like to say that we should have sort of a science of the hustle, you know, the day-to-day life of most people. That's really what makes the city. And some of these people will be poets, some will be artists, some will be builders, some will be chefs, etc. But it's really that diversity of the city, the fact that the environment almost forces us to be creative and come up with new things in order to survive, and the aggregate of all that knowledge and its interconnection that really forms what I think is truly special about cities. The rest is in some sense created the conditions for that. And so you have to somehow abstract a little bit what that is, but also enjoy knowing about different places and what is done here and there. And I think nothing beats, if you really want to know a city, to get a local that loves their city to just show you around, because there's so many things you'll never see otherwise.
And maybe a local who can't stand it.
Yes, exactly. They'll also tell you about things that are wrong with it.
But again, getting back to this question of what is the data that you are collecting?
Like, sure. So we collect almost everything you could think of about cities, and we try to collect it also globally, almost anywhere. So you start obviously with things that are more available, that census bureaus and statistical bureaus tend to collect: population, the size of the city in space, its volume of infrastructure, its size of its economy in terms of, for example, wages or GDP, that sort of thing. And out of that, that was sort of our early work, was really about characterizing that sort of quantity, also violence and crime, measures of innovation, invention, and art and science. So you can bring all these things and start characterizing sort of the city as a place of innovation, the city as a social network, the city as an infrastructural network, the city in space. And you can start to see, in some sense, the interdependencies between these types of quantities. So that was our early work, was really to use all this data to distill something that's general about cities. And the idea then was to, this already revealed again, this fact that cities are kind of different from other complex systems and have this character of really concentrating and accelerating social life, so that the products of social life, both good and bad, crime as well as innovation as well as arts, kind of get compressed and accelerated, so they get more of it per unit time the larger the city. This is typically what you see. Cities then vary because of their local flavor and so forth. So, but then increasingly our work is also about collecting data at the local level inside a city. So you go to the neighborhood and you start understanding how neighborhoods are different from each other, and what kind of change is happening in those places, especially places that are poor and are changing through infrastructure and services or other forms of development. And so at that level, you really start getting the sense of viewing the fabric of a city, the fabric of our lives, if you wish, forming, and also how it mediates all these changes, but how it's seen by an individual in this vast system of other lives and of structured space and wonderful things.
I mean, one thing about a lot of cities is that people in point A have no idea what's happening in point B in the same city.
Right. So that's really interesting, right? Because there's a sense in which they may, if they want to, be able to find out, right? You know, point B may exist. And that's already interesting, because it means that if you really were motivated, you could go and discover and know that part of the city. But so cities strike this interesting balance, right, between being actually very different, very diverse in both positive and negative ways from place to place, being dangerous or safe, being rich or poor, being artistic or boring, or perhaps businesslike or whatever in different places. And at the same time, so it's likely that somebody that's very embedded into one of these flavors doesn't know so much about the others. And so that diversity is predicated on being connected, but being not very much connected, so that you don't know everything about everywhere. You cannot in a very large city. But that tension, that the ingredients for something else are there, and you know about it, but you still don't know them very well, are really part of the dynamics that makes cities latent for change, but also not fully known places for discovery in all kinds of senses.
And as researchers, you presumably are on the ground in every part of the city mm-hmm. that you're studying.
Well, we kind of cannot do that because that would be very time-consuming, and probably we wouldn't know what to do in every place. It would take a long time. But depending on the kind of work we're doing, so a lot of work we're doing now, that's why slums is in the subtitle, is looking at cities that are changing very quickly, particularly in Africa and parts of Asia and some places in Latin America. And in these places, we work with people associated with a large nonprofit called Slum Dwellers International. And we go to neighborhoods that tend to be slums, and we basically interact with people. And then they have processes by which they collect data about their own neighborhoods, and we've been helping them do that. But part of the experience is also seeing people's lives and what they want to change and what they think is going well and not going well. And so we get to see parts of the city through the eyes of people who live there, where we have these contacts. And that's been a tremendously enriching experience, particularly in places that are less familiar to us because they're in different countries. They're slum neighborhoods, so they're places that are very hard to know from the outside. And, you know, frankly, they're unfamiliar circumstances where you start to see development at the human level at a very fine-grained way.
How do you define a slum?
So that's, again, a very good question, a very difficult question. And there's been a lot written about this, and there's no agreement. There's sort of canonical definitions. So UN Habitat, which is a part of the UN that deals with cities and settlements, has a definition. And it's basically a neighborhood where typically buildings are not permanent, where often land is illegally occupied, or at least it's not titled, and where there's a low level of services like water, electricity, and so forth. So that typically tends to be something that you think of is maybe a slum. But actually, as you look at many different situations in many different cities, there are places that you may think are slums that don't have those same characteristics. There have been studies, for example, in LA of buildings that are formal, but they've been occupied and in some senses are slums. In our work, this has been one. I don't like questions of definition because often they're tricky and they're not very productive. But there's a sense in which this is inevitable. It's very important, for example, for policy and urban development. So we've been trying to attack that question from a little bit from the side or from the back. And so what we've been doing is to look at the statistical characteristics of many different neighborhoods, including slum neighborhoods, and try to say, can we distinguish slum neighborhoods from non-slum neighborhoods by somebody's definition? And the answer is, curiously, it's very difficult to do that because there's sort of a continuum. There's a certain sense in which neighborhoods across the city are better serviced, are becoming more legal, or the quality of buildings gets better. But there's no sense in which there's a sharp line across which you just have something you can call a slum and something you can call a non-slum. So this is, I think, is very important, is that despite the local diversity and change, both good and bad, of cities, you also have a continuum of this change. You have a certain sense in which a neighborhood develops from being very, very basic and non-serviced to something that's legal and sophisticated. And in a city, you're likely to find everything in between. Often, even inside the slum, there are better buildings and buildings that are more temporary and so forth. And you see this change in a very fine-grained way.
We're talking to Professor Luis Betancourt of the Santa Fe Institute about cities. It seems like some slums are places where people, when there's a big influx for whatever reason from the countryside to the city, where people go and they're kind of new and made of cheap materials and sort of homemade, so to speak. And then other slums that are like, they've been there for a really long time. Mm-hmm. They're run by slum lords mm-hmm. who don't take care of them and so on. So it seems like there's, within slums, there's a pretty big variation.
Exactly. Not unlike other neighborhoods, actually, when you yeah. think about it, at least in terms of the mechanisms by which they're organized and so forth. So you have to recognize that diversity in order to think about how things may get better, right? And so there's a sense in which slums also are not something new. I think the scale is probably new, but it's also so is the scale of urbanization now. But there's a sense in which you can go to New York or London or Tokyo or Paris, and a large part of those cities at the time where those cities are growing very fast were slums. Lower East Side, for example, was largely a slum for a long time, and it was a slum that persisted poor even though many different generations of people came through of different ethnicities and so forth. So that's also typical, is that a place may remain poor even though people move on and change and often improve their lives. So many subtleties around this. But yes, yeah, so there's a sense in which what we're trying to do is to understand what is the process by which slums form and slums develop. And it connects back again to this idea of fabric. There's a sense in which when cities grow very fast, they don't assemble in terms of all these networks. The social network by which you're connected to, in principle, anybody in the city, and the physical network by which, you know, you have water and you have a road and you have a bus or something to take you somewhere. So when a slum forms, typically you have none of these things in the most basic slum. And what happens gradually is that these things start connecting. Slowly but surely, until that becomes a normal neighborhood. So there's a sense in which people become socially integrated when things go right. You know, of course, they get jobs, they get political rights, they may have titling for their land, or they have some more formal agreement for staying there. This allows buildings to get better, people to invest in them, or building owners to invest in them. It encourages services. And so bit by bit, all these pieces come together and the neighborhood becomes connected. So that's really the opportunity when you look at least the scientific opportunity, is to look at slums as places where the city's forming in terms of this fabric. But when you look also at policy, which we don't quite do, but we talk to people who do, is really a lot of how this is being conceptualized is the formation of this fabric along its several dimensions.
And it gets complicated because of issues like gentrification, where the people who have been longtime residents of a mm-hmm. place that might be called a slum, when it develops, can't mm-hmm. stay there.
Right. So this is not just a problem with slum, right? We see this in every city. You know, this is a hot topic in New York or London, where the financial industry or some other, or San Francisco, where the technology industry gets to do very well, and then other people find it difficult to stay in the same place. So so cities are very dynamical also in that way. And the question then is whether success does not destroy the seeds for their success. You know, Jane Jacobs, a famous urbanist, called this the process of gentrification effectively. She called it the self-destruction of diversity. So there's a sense in which it's a lot of these different flavors, the fact that you may have, you know, restaurants and builders and all kinds of things in the city that makes the place perhaps attractive in the first place. And that may generate, you know, new technologies that are well informed by social life. That's a lot of what's happening now in San Francisco, right? But at the same time, if then an industry does well and real estate prices go up, then the question is whether you destroy that fabric because you make it so... you make it into a monoculture, effectively, right? And so usually what happens is that there's a reconfiguration of space, and there are other neighborhoods that develop. In San Francisco, Oakland's been, of course, the place that's been developing, for example. But in some cities, that's not possible, and you really create zones of exclusion and mixing, and that's not good. So those are very interesting questions. They're not totally settled, but I think we're starting to understand in terms of these dynamics of both change and success and a permanence of a certain diversity and the reconnection of that fabric.
We're talking to Luis Betancourt of the Santa Fe Institute about cities. How do you understand the self-organizing nature of a city on the one hand and its official government on mm-hmm. the other hand, and the dialectic between those things?
Right. So this is another excellent question, of course, a perennial issue that we discuss in... certainly every discussion about policy and development and inequality is about this tension, right? So there's a sense, again, going back to something we said early on, that a lot of what happens in cities in terms of their novelty, their innovation, their ability to change human development has a lot to do with self-organization. It's about people finding their niche, developing their way of life, and being able to do that. And that is something that's very hard to mandate from City Hall or from any other structure of government. How would you even know what person A or person B should do and who they should know and how should they lead their lives? So this sort of deep discussion both in complex systems and in economics, the sense in which most socioeconomic systems really rely fundamentally on people learning and making good decisions as individuals in this in their social organizations. But at the same time, of course, there's a sense in which government needs to exist to guarantee that this is a good environment for that self-organization. So this means, again, many different things. It means fundamentally to have a safe place where people, strangers, can interact and do their creative thing and their business thing. But also means, of course, that there has to be some infrastructure so that we don't spend all our time just surviving and that you spend that time, you know, basically doing socioeconomic activities. That's what humans are good at. So this, again, the tension in development and in cities, going back to slums, is that cities can exist in a state where it's all self-organization. It's all people just surviving, being the infrastructure, carrying the water, getting rid of the waste, and so forth. But that's not a very good city because it's not creating the conditions for people to do sophisticated things in terms of economics, in terms of creativity. And cities that do well open up the space for that to be possible in a self-organized way. But opening up and managing that space needs typically to be done by city government and authorities.
When you look at a place like Santa Fe, where we are living and, you know, we have a new mayor who talks about making this city more attractive to young people, and you look at the bigger picture, which is that Santa Fe became trendy and attractive at a certain point. Well, it's kind of been that way for a century, but especially in the last 20 years, people came here, usually well-to-do older people, bought tons of land, real estate prices went up, rents went up, young people can't come here anymore the way that they used to. Can government do anything about that at all? I mean, it seems like that's part of the self-organizing part of it.
Sure. So this is a similar dilemma to San Francisco in a very different way, or to what you were asking about before, about gentrification, right? It's sort of, in Santa Fe, we're taking your question sort of to the extreme. We may be looking at the self-destruction of our own diversity, the thing that made Santa Fe interesting and keeps making it interesting, in some sense, a vital art scene, a creative scene of many different kinds, whether that can persist if it becomes sort of a very hot and very expensive real estate market, for example. And so I think no one wants that. I think even people who moved here and certainly want it to become a vital, interesting place. And so there are no simple answers to that. It's really a question of how that can be done. The data essentially says that Santa Fe is a fairly rich city for its small size, but it's also one that's very unequal in both, of course, economically, but it's also a place that has had its periods where it's violent and unsafe. Of course, it's not true throughout the city, but and of course, it's a place that has a funny, as you said, demographic hole, particularly in the age of professional adults, so sort of 20-somethings to 40-somethings. We sort of have a place there where a lot of things are common in other cities in terms of business and creative industries are not necessarily very well represented here. Some are in terms of arts and design, but other things are not. So, and of course, there's a sense in which when you look at education in the city and the state, this has been discussed many times, we really don't have a great university, for example, in Santa Fe, or other educational institutions that would allow people to stay here, have their kids in good schools and feel that this is the place to be. So I think that the discussion is how do you keep Santa Fe being creative, but knowing also at the same time that being creative is not a recipe, unfortunately, and that you can create the conditions for that to be possible. But also what we're creative about needs to keep changing. So that's been also the history of cities that done well, is that Santa Fe has a long history based on its historic roots, but it's also a place where, for example, science and technology have now a bit of a place, and what role it may take in creating also a city that has new technologies and new interesting ways of managing itself. Those are the sort of questions that we need to answer as a city. But, you know, Santa Fe certainly has, there's money in Santa Fe. There are people who'd like to Santa Fe to certainly be a creative and interesting place. It has a rich and wonderful history, so we have all the ingredients to do well, and we should not just shoot ourselves in the foot and destroy the diversity that made us interesting.
How do you who have been studying, you and your colleagues, who've been studying the city in tremendous kind of detail and richness and integration, then take that work back to the cities themselves? Do you work with city planners, for example?
So we don't it's almost sort of an attitude at the Institute that we don't get involved with detailed policy. But we do, of course, do science that informs policy. And we certainly, I have a lot of discussions with planners and people all the way from local government all the way to international agencies like World Bank or UN Habitat and so forth. They're all interested in creating policies, in creating interventions that will make cities better at different levels. So I think that... So yes, we have those conversations, and I think part of what's happening in urban planning and policy has been that we really don't have not had a very good understanding of all these processes that we've been talking about now for a little while. You know, a lot of what planners can do is to affect the infrastructure, affect the physical city, but we've often not really understood well how that changes people's lives. And so that connection really between the physical and the social city is something that is the focus of a lot of work, including ours, and that needs to be understood better. Well, so for example, so going back to slums, so one example is if a neighborhood gets better serviced in terms of transportation or water or electricity, what will people do next, right? You know, you could imagine that they'll be happy, but nothing will change. But in some sense, what you'd like to happen, that's at least on some statistical average, is that this will enable people to learn, to get better jobs, to essentially go from a logic of just trying to survive and spinning their wheels to now having the conditions to develop as a place and as individuals in terms of what they can achieve, what they have access to, and so forth. So is that, when does that work? And when does that not work? So it could be that you solve the water problem, but there's some reason why different kinds of people are still socially excluded in a city. I mean, that's the kind of thing that we deal with in developed cities a lot, is that there's a sense in which we've dealt fairly well with the infrastructure and services, but our cities often remain disconnected along economic and ethnic lines in ways that are subtle and difficult. And so you want to understand how to create again this the good things about the fabric of cities, and how to in some sense also intervene to discourage bad ones.
We have in the United States, and probably in many cities in the world, legacies of racism and discrimination. Can urban planning affect those things, improve those things?
Sure, and I think you see a lot of examples coming. So it's kind of funny because, so I travel a lot throughout the world and I see many different cities, both sort of developed and developing. And I've developed sort of this sense of the feeling in different places. And particularly when the United States and some places in Western Europe, there's this pessimism about cities that now has gone on for maybe two generations, that cities are places of these deep divisions, often across racial lines or economic lines, that some neighborhoods have remained poor for a very long time. Parts of New York, parts of Chicago are infamous for this. And they've been studied intensely by many people in these cities. And that things are not changing. In some sense, perhaps inequality is getting worse and things are getting worse. So when you then go to many developing cities, you see, of course, the starting point is much worse. There's much more poverty and inequality and so forth, and many more things to achieve. But there's a sense in which things in many places are moving in the right direction. You see, economic development, human development along many dimensions. And effectively, it's a broad generalization, but the recipe for that is really this knowledge of what allows somebody, anybody, to be integrated in the system that's a city. Integrated socially, integrated, of course, physically. And it's therefore to try to understand the conditions that some may be affected by policy, others are more subtle, that by which somebody may be able to get a job, may be able to have access to training or education, may be able to be able to have childcare or whatever other conditions, so that you can become sort of not isolated and become integrated in the social system that allows you to change and hopefully improve your life. And I think in the United States, a lot of the urban planning, certainly of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, were really large infrastructural works that created more physical separation in the city. And so we were talking about Detroit before. Part of what happened to Detroit is that it's sort of almost like a Greek tragedy, being Motown, is that with all the highway systems and so forth, in some sense the city became much larger spatially and became separated physically, so that there are very rich suburbs and very poor parts of the city. And the connections between those parts of the city have become effectively severed also because of the economic decay of some of the sectors. So there's a sense in which you can create the conditions for people to be more integrated. And so, for example, I've just been in Medellin, Colombia, which 20 years ago was the murder capital of the world. And what you find is that it's an incredible city. It's sort of an alpine valley, but of course on the equator in the tropics. And most of the city is built on hills, very steep hills, and they're basically slums. Now, most of houses are made of brick, but basically these were places that during the big years of drug trafficking and so forth, these are completely separated from the rest of the city. The infrastructure and services are provided by drug cartels and so forth. So what eventually was done was to create transportation systems, which are sort of cable cars and escalators and things like that, and put public spaces in neighborhoods that didn't have anything, so that effectively people need to move around the city across economic lines and ethnic lines, and the city becomes more connected. And this seems to be working very well. So there are physical infrastructure changes, but in some sense the spirit of them is to create the social fabric of an integrated city.
What surprises have you found in your research?
Well, the first surprise is really to have a sense of what cities really are. You know, throughout history you've had all these ideas of maybe cities are like, social insects, so beehives or organisms or machines. All these have been metaphors about perhaps what the city was. And in fact, a lot of policy and a lot of interventions have been made in cities through those points of view. And most of them have been very unsuccessful, to say the least. So,
what do you mean?
Well, so for example, we were just discussing about building a lot of roads, and that sometimes can be good and sometimes can be bad, right? So, but the idea is that actually back then in sort of the 50s and 60s, the idea is that you brought this metaphor before, that there was sort of a circulatory system to the city, and that if you create a better one, the city would work better. But, you know, city is not just movement, right? It's in some sense interaction more than it is movement. Movement works because allows interactions to work, but interactions are primary to movement. So if you just have a lot of movement, you'll spend a lot of energy in these cities for just having everything move around, but you will not necessarily create the conditions for the city to be a place of connection between people. And so that was really what happened, is that actually that created the conditions in many cases for social separation rather than integration. So that's one example. But I think that perhaps the biggest surprise is really this idea that when you think about the role of cities in human societies, and when you see what has changed to human societies when they urbanized, this idea that they went from not totally static, but essentially a logic of subsistence and small-scale societies to these now immense societies that change very quickly and that have created all the trappings of civilization, both good and bad. That's what you need to understand. What is that process? And I think the big surprise is to really have an insight on what that is. It's this idea that when you connect intelligent agents, they're able to learn different things. You create the conditions for a society of humans to actually have, on the whole, all this information that's much larger than the sum of the parts. And so the creation of that fabric and the changing that fabric with the size of the city, but also with technological changes that allow larger and larger cities and their integration to exist. It's really understanding that process, which ultimately, you know, is maybe the process that makes us uniquely human. It's really the process by which we've been so inventive and so creative in good and bad ways. So I think the biggest surprise is the understanding the essence of that process.
Luis Betancourt is a professor at the Santa Fe Institute. He will be giving a talk tonight titled The Fabric of Our Lives, Cities, Slums, Neighborhoods, and People. That's at 7:30 tonight at the James A. Little Theater on the campus of the New Mexico School for the Deaf. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
My pleasure.